not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, for the first segment, we talk with independent journalist Dave Lindorf about the ongoing U.S. corporate media propaganda regarding Venezuela. We'll have updates on the latest propaganda from the New York Times, CNN, and more. And in the second segment, we're joined by lawyer and activist Michael D.D. White of Citizens Defending Libraries in New York City. We'll talk about the assault on the public sphere and the public's right to know, from the takeover and sales of public libraries and spaces to surveillance capitalism and much more. Stay with us.
Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguised under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. On today's program, for the first segment, we're going to be talking about corporate media and establishment media propaganda in the United States, particularly around Venezuela. We've been talking about this issue for some time. And of course, our first guest today is also no stranger to our audience. It is Dave Lindorf from ThisCan'tBeHappening.net, longtime independent journalist, has been published in numerous platforms from Fair to Salon. And of course, his site is ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. He's won several Project Censored Awards over the year, and most recently, the I.F. Stone Award, the Izzy from the Park Institute of Independent Media over at Ithaca College. Dave Lindorf, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Glad to be back. Thanks for having me, Mickey.
It's a pleasure, Dave. And now you've got two pieces just in the last couple of weeks. One, the failed coup, actually a corporate fake news story designed to trick Venezuelan soldiers and the public. That goes back to May 5 at ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. And then you have another one that you just published, May 14. Who knows? Who cares? If the media claim 50 countries reject Venezuela's elected president and repeat it enough, it must be true. You've been following this story, obviously, for some time. Give us a little bit of background and tell us how you came to your recent May 5 piece, and then we'll cut it up to the present. Go ahead, Dave.
On the night of the coup, the so-called coup, on the 30th of April, I was reading about what was going on, and I was thinking, oh my God, a coup. This is terrible. I was reading the New York Times and the Guardian and stuff, and it all was talking about the masses rising up in response to Guaido's call for them to do it, and that he was speaking from an airbase that was liberated by dissenting soldiers. And I thought, oh my God, it's really happening, and this is horrible. And then I thought, well, I'm going to look at some other press. So I started looking at Telesur English and Al Jazeera. And when I read those, there was no takeover of the base, that Guaido was not on the base when he gave his press conference, or call to arms, as it were, that 25 soldiers who had deserted had asked for asylum in the Brazilian embassy, and that the guy that was with him, the leader of his party, Leonardo Lopez, had asked for asylum in the Chilean embassy and then moved over to the Spanish embassy with his family and, you know, his wife and kids. And I thought, wait, this doesn't sound like a successful coup to me. You know, it's really funny. I wrote a piece saying that this was all a fake, that it was a call from a bridge outside the base, and that he pretended that he had soldiers lined up around him and that masses of people were talking to him when they weren't, and that all the signs pointed to it being a fake. And then I mentioned the things from Al Jazeera, that people were in the embassies getting asylum. And then I sat there and I said to my wife, should I pull the trigger on this and say that this coup is a fraud? And, you know, I told her what I got there, and she said, well, yeah, I think you should. So I just figured, okay, I'm going to either look like a prescient journalist or I'm going to look like a fool tomorrow morning. And the next morning, the news started trickling into the mainstream press that this was not what it looked like and had been totally fake. So then comes articles afterwards. And, you know, when the U.S. media just piled on this thing when the coup was supposedly happening, talking about how Maduro was going down and the masses were rising up, And they all had believed it. They believed, they were writing that Guaido was speaking from this liberated base, air base in Caracas. And then they were backtracking a little bit, but they didn't at first. So the articles that were coming out, I guess on the 4th, were still saying that Guaido had been on the base and the base had been liberated. So at that point, I thought, this is really crap journalism, because if the Times has a whole hassle of journalists down in Caracas, and CNN certainly does, and with camera crews and stuff, where's the video of Guaido on the base? And they had this very tight video, CNN, with a couple of soldiers and Guaido, and no masses, and they didn't even show that it was a bridge. So what was happening was they were really faking the story. They did know the answer, that it wasn't true. They knew he wasn't on the base, and the Times reporters were so lazy that they didn't do what you'd normally expect them to do, which would be to hop in a cab and go to the base. They were taking their stuff from a social media video that was made by Guaido. What kind of journalism is that? I was just appalled. I mean, even for the Times, this was bad. CNN, I mean, they spend all this money to put camera crews down there, and they can't go to the site to get video of it?
So, Dave, how much of this is poor or even misleading reporting on behalf of the journalists on the ground there? Or how much of it is actually Guaido's ability to stage these photo shoots and manipulate U.S. media?
There's no way that this was them being manipulated, because they can't be that shabby journalists that they wouldn't want to be on the scene of a takeover of a military base. That's a huge thing, to take over a military base. And to not want to be on the ground showing it, interviewing the soldiers and interviewing the people who would obviously be thronging onto the base and everything. You know, if I could tell on the night of the 30th that it was a fake, because I was getting the reports from Telesur and Al Jazeera about the asylum seeking by these guys, including the soldiers, then so could the copy editors at the Times and the desk editors for the Latin American desk or the international desk, looking at these stories and checking them out. That's what editors are supposed to do. So I have to believe that this was a concerted effort by the Times and CNN and some of the other media that were doing it that I didn't bother to check, to bolster a ploy that was to pretend there was a coup in hopes that the masses would come out and the soldiers would defect.
So, Dave, if all of what you're saying is true and the American media is spreading this false information about Guaido's supposedly successful coup, it makes you wonder why this misinformation would be targeted here towards American citizens. And so my question for you is whether or not you believe that this is all part of the U.S. government or mainstream media's need or desire to have public support for a military intervention in Venezuela.
I doubt that that's the reason. I think there's a circular media that the people in Venezuela are getting U.S. media. They probably don't trust their own media because they know it's all owned by oligarchs. They got the state media, which is Maduro's, and then they got all the oligarch media that's right-wing. And so the poor people of Venezuela, what are they supposed to believe except the street gossip between those two sources? So they probably look to CNN, International, and things like that and hope for the best. And here it is saying that there's a coup. We're in an international media world now. So when CNN International says there's a coup and shows video of it, cutting it down so that it looks like he's standing with troops when he announces it, then people are going to believe, oh, they took over the base. Let's go out into the streets. And, of course, that caused some injuries and death because the few hundred people who did venture out towards the airport were blocked and hit with resistance attacks by the troops that were defending the airport. They wouldn't have gone there if they hadn't been led to believe that it was a done deal.
Dave Lindorf, listeners want to follow this. We're speaking about a recent piece that Dave Lindorf wrote for FAIR. There's a few pieces, actually. One, of course, is on how a corporate fake news story designed to trick Venezuelan soldiers and the public. That's the one we're talking about right now. And there's a couple of others. But Dave Lindorf, there's another one, too. I mean, again, this is part of the troubling historical pattern. If we go back in U.S. history, we know that the corporate media, establishment media, they go in sync. They try a couple stories and trial balloons, and if one doesn't stick, they shift and they try another, or they then go back, double down, and repeat it. We know that the New York Times was reporting bogus stories that they finally had to retract about Maduro sabotaging aid, and we found out that it was Guaido's people doing it false flag style. We also know that CNN is embedded with the anti-Maduro people on the ground and the Guaido people, so they're boasting about how they're reporting from the ground about the opposition, tacitly admitting that they're biased while pretending that they're a legitimate news source on the ground in Venezuela. I mean, granted, people should be going to Venezuela Analysis and several other sources, but most people in the U.S. don't know about those sources. CNN was also caught not long ago. Jason Ditz wrote about this. CNN falsely claims Venezuela's Guaido was elected president. Was there an election that we didn't know about?
Yeah, right. No, it was in the spring of 2018.
Yeah, and Maduro won with 67% of the vote. Guaido didn't even participate in the election. But CNN was reporting that, you know, pressure's mounting for Maduro to step down following elections. This is a quote, following elections in January in which voters chose opposition leader Juan Guaido over him for president.
Where the hell did that come from? Where would they have gotten that?
This is something that people in the American public definitely need to know about. And again, this is the New York Times, the so-called paper of record. And as you wrote, they either made no effort to check its reporters' facts or went along deliberately with the charade that Washington's hand-picked, quote, legitimate president Guaido was actually speaking from the liberated military airfield. It's just amazing.
And I think we know the answer, because if it had been the reporters doing that kind of shoddy reporting, they'd have been fired.
Well, one would think so. But I mean, you know, this day and age, that might be call for promoting someone. We like to say at Project Censored, the New York Times is all the news that fits the print. The story and the frame are already predetermined.
And by the way, the speaking of fake news, the next story I want to work on is there was a big piece by William Broad, the science editor at the New York Times, that's a real hit piece on RT TV. His article reads like a parody of a propaganda piece. It's unbelievable. He over and over uses experts say for his sourcing about how RT is just a propaganda vehicle to disseminate fake news and dissension within the United States to undermine our democracy. I mean, it's really, really bad. He actually listed three main sources, which he called internet security experts. And when I looked them up, the three companies were all connected to U.S. intelligence.
We're speaking with independent journalist Dave Lindorf, speaking about a trilogy of articles that he's written about Venezuela and corporate media propaganda in the United States. I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. We'll continue our conversation with Dave Lindorf, thiscan'tbehappening.net, after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are honored to be rejoined by award-winning independent journalist Dave Lindorf from thiscan'tbehappening.net. We're discussing some pieces that he wrote recently, one for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Dave is also a multiple-time winner of Project Censored Awards and most recently won the I.F. Stone Award. No small accomplishment. the Izzy Awards from Park Institute for Independent Media at Ithaca College. Dave Lindorf, when we left off, we were talking about the New York Times as a major propaganda arm, and of course, we'll continue down that road. One of the pieces you've written recently is, who knows, who cares? If the media claim 50 countries reject Venezuela's elected president and repeat it enough, it must be true. Now, we touched on this a little earlier, but again, this is trying to delegitimize the Maduro presidency by claiming that Juan Guaido, well, CNN claimed he was elected in January, which is patently false. But now they're using the ad populum fallacy that they say enough countries reject it, that he must go. So tell us a little bit about your recent story.
Well, I started wondering, everywhere I read, I hear stories about Venezuela in the U.S. press, there's always this line that at least 50 countries have decided that Juan Guaido, this 35-year-old puppet created by U.S. intelligence and the State Department, is the legitimate president of Venezuela, and that Maduro is a usurper because he was selected in a fraudulent election from 2018. So let's pick that apart. First of all, that election was boycotted by most of the opposition parties. So even though only about half of the electorate in Venezuela voted instead of the usual 75-85% who vote, he won by 68% of that half a vote, which almost would have won the election if everybody had voted, probably would have won had everybody voted. But the opposition decided on a strategy, probably at the advice of the U.S., to say they weren't going to run because it was a fraud. So that's one thing. But meanwhile, Jimmy Carter, he's viewed these elections, and he has said that Venezuela has one of the fairest and most foolproof electoral systems in the world. But it's now called a fraud every time it's said regarding elections in Venezuela. But the other point is that they say that these 50 countries are saying that Guaido is the legitimate president. So I started thinking, why have I never seen that list? It's never, usually when they say that, you know, like remember the Coalition of the Willing in Iraq? They did once in a while run that list. It was kind of a funny list. You know, it was like little Marianas or Solomon Islands and stuff like that, that would do whatever the U.S. said to do. And it was kind of a standing joke that this was the Coalition of the Willing. So I wanted to see the list, and I couldn't find it. I Googled all over the place, so it just wasn't there. The best I got was an article in Bloomberg that came up with 13 countries that were calling Guaido the legitimate ruler and six that were not. Actually, they said five because they left out Nicaragua, which is an ardent supporter of Maduro. So it's really 6 to 13. And most of them are like real suck-ups to the U.S., so you can hardly count it. And then they left out totally all of Africa, which all are supporting it. So then I looked into further, and I found out that 141 countries support Maduro and have open embassies from Venezuela. In Europe, they're not saying that Guaido is the legitimate ruler. They're saying that they don't want military intervention and they don't want a coup, but they want to see the crisis resolved by early elections. So they're not supporting Maduro, but they're not supporting Guaido. And so it's not 50 countries. And yet that is now the standard factoid that's in every article about the Venezuelan situation, is 50 countries support Guaido as the legitimate president. Simply not true, but it's repeated over and over and over. And so everybody repeats it because if they look in the clips, that's what it says. But I asked the State Department for the list, and they said, oh, we'll get you that. But they didn't. And how hard could it be if there is a list?
So Dave Lindorf, help us and our listeners understand what Guaido is referring to when he refers to his claim to the presidency. Let's assume, under his premise, that the 2018 vote was fraudulent. That still doesn't explain why Guaido is now a self-appointed president. Can you explain what he is referring to when he is calling himself president?
Yeah, he's the head of something called the National Assembly, but it's not really the parliament of Venezuela. It's like an alternative government kind of trying to be, and it's been ruled illegitimate by the courts. So it really is a non-entity, and he is himself a nonentity, and he hasn't run for the presidency or any party. So he's a 35-year-old nobody who's been elevated by the State Department and the CIA.
Well, he's a neoliberal spokesperson in Venezuela that the U.S. And look, this isn't the first time the U.S. has been trying to support a coup in Venezuela, obviously.
And one of the things you can see is he speaks English and went to Georgetown. So part of his appeal to the U.S. is that he can talk to American reporters and speak to the American media and to the American public. So he becomes a more palatable figure than, say, Maduro, who doesn't speak English.
Well, Dave Lindorf, we have about 5 minutes left in this segment, and I wanted to touch on something domestically that's not happening too far away from you in the nation's capital at the Venezuelan embassy. Of course, we know there are some people reporting from inside the embassy. The embassy has been under assault from right-wing supporters of Guaido. The electricity was being turned off. Have you been keeping up with this? This hasn't been being covered very much in the corporate media.
No, very little. When you consider the fact that there's a country that has an embassy which has certain special international rights under Geneva Conventions dating back to the turn of the century or before, that it's the property of the government of whatever country has that embassy, and it's sovereign territory belonging to that country under international law. So here's this embassy, and the U.S. has decided it doesn't recognize Maduro, so therefore it doesn't recognize his authority in the embassy, and so they're trying to get the Maduro people out of there, and they're not leaving. So it's kind of a standoff, but they're blocking them from getting food, from having electricity, from having medicine, and so on. So people are down there defending the embassy from the outside and trying to get food into them and that kind of stuff.
That's actually a pretty big issue. And again, it hasn't been getting that much attention here, but there definitely are people that are on the ground there and are supporting it. Of course, people like Medea Benjamin, Code Pink, and some other folks have certainly been there. Margaret Flowers and others have been there. So it's not that people aren't reporting. It's just that what's coming out of the embassy is pretty astounding. There's a degree of surprise and astonishment that this is all happening while the Capitol Police and others just watch it happen.
Compare that to when the U.S. Embassy was taken over in Iran or something. You know, like it's oh my God, look what they're doing to us. But this is another example of where we've got a real double standard. We're not upholding the Geneva Conventions.
No, we're definitely not doing a great job of that, Dave Lindorf. So in the last 2 minutes here that we have, I know you told us a little bit about one of the pieces that you're going to be working on, but something tells me that you're not done with Venezuela yet.
I'm sure there's more to write, but I think that Guaido is pretty much a goner in terms of being a national leader of Venezuela. I think one of the things that's being missed here in the U.S. media is the loathing throughout Latin America and throughout Venezuela particularly of U.S. intervention and manipulation of their countries and their governments. And that's why I don't think a coup can succeed in Venezuela, because even if, and I don't accept it as a premise, even if Maduro is a corrupt thug or an incompetent administrator, the people of Venezuela, by and large, know that they're better off with Maduro, who was the handpicked successor to the very popular Hugo Chavez, than they would be under whatever government gets put in place through the manipulations and intervention of the U.S.
You know, Dave Lindorf, we're going to have to let you go at this point, but you reminded me a couple times during this segment of an old quote from George W. Bush when he was resident of the White House. George W. Bush said, "You see, in my line of work, you've got to keep repeating things over and over and over again to kind of catapult the propaganda." Do you remember that quote?
Yeah.
He said, "You got to repeat things over and over and over again for the truth to sink in.
To make your own reality," as Karl Rove said.
That's right, in the interview with Ron Suskind. Well, on that note, Dave Lindorf, I'm sure we'll have much more to discuss in the near future, and we look forward to having you back on the Project Censored show.
Okay, thanks for having me on, Mickey.
Thanks. That's Dave Lindorf, award-winning reporter from ThisCan'tBeHappening.net. Up next on the Project Censored show, we're going to be speaking with lawyer, urban planner, a former senior government finance and development officer, writer, and activist Michael White from Citizens Defending Libraries will be with us for a very interesting conversation about the importance of libraries, the public sphere. Maybe we'll even be getting into high-definition radio and other topics, so please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. On this segment of the program, we are honored to be joined by Michael White. He is a lawyer, urban planner. He's a former senior government finance and development official. He's also a writer and an activist. He's affiliated with Citizens Defending Libraries. You can read more at citizensdefendinglibraries.blogspot.com. But Michael White is going to be joining us for this segment of the show, and he's going to be talking about various issues, particularly surrounding the First Amendment. So, Michael White, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mickey, and I'm very pleased to be on your show. I think virtually by definition, the Project Censored radio show is one of the most important on the air. And, of course, all the work Project Censored does is really fabulous.
Well, Michael White, we appreciate that. And, of course, we've crossed paths online before, and you do incredible work based out in New York City. But why don't you help our listeners understand a little bit more about what you do and why it's so important with Citizens Defending Libraries?
Well, I'm a co-founder, and we formed Citizens Defending Libraries in 2013 in response to the then-breaking headlines that allowed us to connect the dots about New York City library sales, the shrinkages of the libraries going on, the elimination of the books, and the deprofessionalization of the librarians. The main central reference library in New York was under threat at that time. The Donnell Library, another big Manhattan library, had been sold off in 2007, and I don't think people have realized what had happened. The second biggest library in Brooklyn was up for sale just when we formed, and it partly provoked our response. The biggest science library in the city was going to be gotten rid of. And there was an overall strategic plan for the entire system of the NYPL and the Brooklyn Library System. They want to have that adopted by all three. There are three library systems in New York. Now, we're talking about Citizens Defending Libraries being for New York City, but it has implications for the rest of the country. So at the Brooklyn Public Library Trustees meeting, they were talking about how they want to take this and export the model to other cities afterward. We see in England, they're spending more on security to keep libraries closed than the cost that they would spend to have librarians there to keep them open. And you can ask whether this is something to do with tech and books are not important, but that's not really the case. In Austin, Texas, they've got a big new library that they're launching, and they've got plenty of books there by comparison. And last time I was in Australia not long ago, the libraries there are beautiful, and they're just chock full of books, and the librarians are just incredible, and they're treated well and paid well. So since we've formed, we've had our successes. We were involved in a couple of lawsuits that prevented the 42nd Street Central Reference Library in Manhattan from being destroyed. A lot of people know that library because it's a world-famous library. It's the one with the two lions outside, Patience and Fortitude. We were actually called up by Mayor de Blasio. We got started during an election year, and so that helped us get a lot of traction because people, the candidates, wanted to be on the side of libraries, and de Blasio was one of the candidates at the time who actually changed his position in order to get our support into a rally. But then behind the scenes, he was taking money from developers who wanted to get libraries handed off to them. We fended off shrinkage of the Red Hook Library. We got the Sunset Park community alerted and able to protect themselves better. The Inwood community has benefited from us being a watchdog. And I hope that by being a watchdog, we've prevented some worse things from happening. But we're not necessarily winning all of our fights.
Michael White, I just recall, I wanted to interject that this is something that's also happening with post offices around the country.
Yeah, actually, when we were defending the second biggest library in Brooklyn, we ran into a New York Times reporter at the library who was there looking for us so that he could write an article about the sale of libraries. And we said, listen, it's not just this library. It's all of the city's libraries that are under threat. And it's not just the libraries. They have similar privatization for the schools to turn them into real estate deals and the post offices. And we had a hard time convincing him at the time that that was case. We sat down and we basically scoped out an article for him. He disappeared for more than a month. And then an article appeared in the front page of the Times, and it didn't mention us. It didn't mention that we had furnished most of the information and leads for the article. It just was an article about why it's really great to be selling off libraries, schools, and post offices.
Well, you know, Richard Blum was a big player in the post office issue. Peter Byrne, a Northern California journalist, actually wrote extensively about that story, including saving the post office in Berkeley, California. I'm glad you shared that story with us. That's disturbing. In the earlier segment, we were just talking with Dave Lindorf about the great propaganda arm that is called the New York Times, and you just gave us another example of how that goes, of how it's more of a neoliberal publication in this sense. And the fact that they're not defending libraries or the public's right to know is really anathema. So you're describing an uphill battle here, Michael White. So continue with the story here, because this is something that's still going on. You have a history of fighting these kinds of battles. And so tell our listeners a little bit more about it, about what you're doing in New York City.
I do want to say that we were formed after another group called the Committee to Save the New York Public Library, which was defending the main Manhattan libraries. But we picked up right at the time when Ada Louise Huxtable and Michael Kimmelman, both essentially architectural critics, very well-known and influential in New York, had been writing about just how stupid it was to be gutting the Central Reference Library and eliminating 3 million books from the stacks underneath the reading room where they were designed for quick access. And there were a lot of important people that were helping out in that fight, you know, people like Salman Rushdie and E.L. Doctorow, Tom Stoppard, David Nassau. But when we arrived on the scenes, we were really the first people who were pointing out how the decimation, the dismantling of the libraries was connected with and being fueled by real estate deals. Now, in New York, it's sort of axiomatic to talk about the influence of the real estate industry as being analogous to New York City politics, as what the fossil fuel industry is to national politics. So it's very influential. And the plans to dismantle the libraries were really quite elaborate and insidious. So, for instance, they extended even to the creation of a corporation called Spaceworks, which was a real estate corporation, technically a nonprofit, but it was run by political real estate operatives, formed pretty much, if you look at their literature, for the purpose of shrinking libraries, taking over and banking what was viewed as useless library real estate. This is all accompanied with a lot of rhetoric about how they are reimagining libraries for the 21st century. What that really equals is a pressure to dismantle traditional libraries, and it especially means eliminating books. Now the books get removed, the shelves are empty in the libraries that they plan to shrink. And then they can, by the time they get around to saying that we're going to shrink the library, they say, well, we're not getting rid of any books because they've gotten rid of them beforehand.
Yeah, Michael White, it reminds me of Henry Giroux, not reimagining, it's like disimagining. It's a euphemistic and Orwellian in a way of alleging that they're reforming it or updating it for the 21st century. What they're paving the way to do is take control of the real estate and leave the public high and dry, no?
Yeah, and I was going to bring up Henry Giroux in just a moment. I do want to say that this attack on physical books, where they are making fun of them, and you find library officials referring to physical books as artifactual originals or old-fashioned analog books. But the reason I was going to bring up Giroux is, although we started in 2013 and could see the real estate connections, the plans to sell off the libraries really go back at least to 2005, and they probably go back to the beginning of the Bloomberg administration, 2003, 2004. He came in right after 9/11, for those who are not familiar with the New York timeline. But very early on, people were spotting that things were amiss at the libraries, and two librarian authors, John E. Bushman and Ed DeAngelo, both wrote books, Bushman's Dismantling the Public Sphere and Ed DeAngelo, Barbarians at the Gate of the Public Library. And they were spotting these trends that were sort of subtle, but they were undermining the proper functioning of libraries. And they talk a lot about Henry Giroux and his theories of what you need to have an effective public sphere to have democracy. And libraries are important as a necessary interstitial space, a realm for public discourse, a place where you can escape privatization generally. And it sort of goes along with Occupy Wall Street, if you will, where, you know, you need public spaces for assembly, public spaces that are neutral to think. And they were pointing out that we've been redefining our library spaces as essentially private enterprise, consumer and market driven places. And instead of thinking of library users as individuals and citizens, we start thinking of them as consumers.
So, Michael, on that point of the privatization of libraries, I think younger generations, when they think of where all the books are today, we think about Amazon. Amazon is almost like, or perhaps it is, the world's largest library in some sense. So can you speak a little bit to how Amazon and their model of starting out by being a online book sale and just the power that they have and the wealth and control over all of the books circulating today?
I think that we don't ask enough questions about how Amazon started and whether it was an accident, how it started and how it succeeded, and whether it was an accident that it started with selling books and selling books with a model that was undermining the publishing industry and the rest of the book industry. And, you know, they were the first big driver pushing people into digital books. And digital books, we have one page up on Citizens Defending Libraries about digital versus physical books. And we have another page up, which is also relevant, about surveillance in the libraries. One thing that people don't realize about digital books is when you read a digital book, the digital book reads you or can read you. It can send information back to the publisher about what page you're on, what page you're flipping back to, where you're reading fast, where you're reading slow, what you're skipping over. Digital books also can be changed as you read them. There is a very famous incident, which involved Amazon, by the way, the 1984 incident, where people were reading on their Kindle, and they opened up their Kindle to read it again, and 1984 was gone. Amazon had made a screw up and purchased the licensing right, and their solution was simply to remove it from the Kindles, and then if you were sharp-eyed, you spotted that you got some sort of credit on your credit card for the disappeared book. But Jeff Bezos has a strange background that people don't talk about much. His maternal grandfather was his main mentor, and that's a fellow who was Lawrence Preston Guy's. And he was very involved with DARPA, which was very involved in starting up the internet. And the internet is very closely related to what Amazon is and the way it's taking over everything.
Speaking of Amazon taking over everything, just to stay on Amazon a little bit longer, you've talked about how, yes, Amazon began by being the online book retailer, and then they acquired Kindle and really helped spread this idea of the ebook, which you're talking about now. It's also worth noting that they acquired the company Goodreads, which is the social rating platform for these books, which provides them with all these 4- and 5-star reviews for the books. Now, Jeff Bezos has spoken publicly about why they decided to start with ebooks, and the reason that him and the company give was that books were relatively similar in size, and therefore they had pretty good understanding about the margins for shipping the books across the country because of the fact that they're all pretty much rectangular in size and at the most are only a certain weight. But you're essentially, and maybe I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me like you might be hinting at the fact that Amazon's real value there was in seeing what their consumers were reading about, what information those readers were consuming.
Absolutely. And as Amazon has grown and gotten into other things, it's now into video content. So I regularly check out for experimental purposes and also just to be able to access stuff where different documentaries and sometimes controversial movies are available. And I always get uneasy when I find that one of the only places I can get certain films is from Amazon or Amazon Prime. You know, once upon a time, if you will, you remember just walking down almost any street in America, and you didn't have to walk very far before you saw the video store, which employed a lot of people.
Or the record store. Yeah, I mean, any of these places, right? Yeah.
They were very locally involved. That's where you got your advice on what you should be buying or renting.
Well, Michael White, I have to interject very quickly because I have to do a quick station ID and remind our listeners that you are tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, McGee Huff, with co-host Chase Palmieri. We're speaking with lawyer, activist, and co-founder of Citizens Defending Libraries, Michael White. We'll continue with that conversation and conclude the Project Censored Show after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, with Chase Palmieri. We're speaking with Michael White of Citizens Defending Libraries, and in fact, getting so much information about protecting the public sphere, protecting libraries. Libraries is a vehicle of information and debate. Before the break, we heard Chase and Michael White talking about Amazon, the history of Amazon, what some of their motives are. And Michael White, I wanted to just go back about the, quote, accident of Amazon and books and digital books. You mentioned Jeff Bezos before, and you mentioned DARPA. Could you expand a little bit on that and some of the other links?
Yeah, I think one of the good books out recently is Yasha Levine's Surveillance Valley, because the internet is looked at as an unquestionable friend to us in many ways. And the origins of the internet, they're all interrelated with the military. Originally, there was a lot of suspicion about surveillance. And in fact, the internet is beautifully designed for surveillance. We're all very conscious now that with the internet, we get what people are referring to as surveillance capitalism. But what the corporations can do in terms of that kind of surveillance translates readily to what our government can do and what people long ago feared they'd be able DARPA, the Defense Research Group, was really the group that gave birth to the internet. And that was where you found Lawrence Preston Guise's maternal grandfather, who was his principal mentor in life. His adopted father, you know, also has an interesting identity because he's someone who came over as part of Operation Pedro or Operation Peter Pan from Cuba. And that's been described as an operation that was organized by the CIA to bring over the children of privileged families from Cuba, partly to work at destabilizing the Cuban government. So I do have up at Citizens Defending Libraries a visual, and I think it's informative, and I invite you to put it up as a visual for this interview. It's five converging arrows, and it's interests and forces that are averse to the continuation of the traditional library. So there's clearly the real estate industry in New York, but there's also the content industry, which is interested, like the real estate industry, in ownership and privatization. These things bleed into each other. You also have Silicon Valley and the digital book companies, and behind their models, the ideas of surveillance capitalism.
On the point of surveillance capitalism, and maybe this will be the last question I have for you on Amazon and this the current state of surveillance capitalism online, I'm wondering if you can speak to the Prime membership at all. Because what I see when I look at Prime membership is a way for Amazon to promise discounts, but ultimately to track you across all of their different businesses. And so, for example, we've been talking about Amazon's Kindle, so that they know what you're reading. Amazon.com, they know what you're ordering. Amazon Prime Video, they know what you're watching.
Whole Foods,
they even know what you're eating. And I'm sure there are other businesses like Twitch where they can know what you're watching there. But can you speak to how Prime membership, this kind of thing that all consumers seem to be buying into now to get their little discounts at Whole Foods and elsewhere, how that ties into this idea of surveillance capitalism?
Well, I'm not sure I'm going to do a good job on that, but you know, it's very hard to escape Amazon and the major internet companies from knowing everything about you. One thing I think might be worth discussing, but I don't know that we can get into it now, is something called social network analytics and the way that's used, because human beings are individuals, but we also are herd animals. And so in terms of knowing what's going on and knowing what needs to be fended off, it can be thought of in terms of very big pictures. And you just have to worry about overall trends and steering them, diverting them, heading them off, or neutralizing them. I think that's something that hasn't been discussed enough. I know back in February of 2018, you had Rob Williams on, and you were discussing the updates of the manufacturing consent filters that affect what information gets through to you.
The propaganda model.
Yeah, and so he talked about algorithms, and he talked about filter bubbles and behavioral micro-targeting and sock puppets, but he didn't talk about social network analytics. And basically, because we're herd animals, you've all seen those pictures of the swarms of the birds in the sky, and they all turn in unison, and you've seen the schools of fish, something will scare them, and they'll all turn in unison and go away. Those are behaviors that also can apply to keeping track of what's going on in our social networks. And when you have companies that can do the rest of surveillance capitalism, they can also be keeping track of all of that kind of information about you. When you have physical libraries and people are going in and out, pulling books off the shelves, it escapes all of that.
In fact, Michael, going back to the Patriot Act, librarians were on the front lines of trying to protect people's privacy and to stop this kind of wanton surveillance in the public sphere. Librarians, again, are some of the chief people to really fight for the right of the public to have access to information and the right to privacy. And, you know, when you get rid of these physical spaces and you get rid of libraries, it's kind of a de facto way of getting rid of librarians.
Librarians citing laws about privacy that were supposed to establish libraries as zones of privacy, were the first people to fight and then contest the Privacy Act. Now, right after a group of Connecticut librarians had their success, the NYPL trustees were being told in their meeting that they were going to need to make accommodations at the New York Public Library to assist in federal surveillance. This is in the minutes. And then along with that, roughly the same time, when they're adopting these plans to overhaul the libraries, the company that they hire to take it over is Booz Allen. And Booz Allen is a private company, but it works for governments to do surveillance.
Going way back, Peter Dale Scott's written a lot about that. For the listeners that know, Booz Allen Hamilton was also the firm with Edward Snowden.
Absolutely.
So these are some of the same culprits.
And no one has picked up on that. There's a lot of stuff that's going on with respect to the libraries that's not getting reported, including we've sent out press releases. First library that was sold was the Donnell Library. One of the principal financial beneficiaries of that sale was Donald Trump's son-in-law. And so Jared Kushner and his family was a principal financial beneficiary on one side. On the other side, you had Stephen Schwartzman, the head of the Blackstone Group, as a trustee of the NYPL Library. And none of this gets reported, even though the sale of that library was essentially a no-bid sale. It was very secret. And it's connected with 666 Fifth Avenue, which is in the news because they want to report on how the Russiagate meetings occurred in it, because it's the headquarter of the Kushner's real estate family operations. But they don't want to, you know, talk about how it was connected to one of the most inexcusable library sales that really launched these library sales in 2007, where a central library was sold off to put up a luxury tower. And when that was done, luxury real estate really became the priority with the public not in mind. So now you can go to the luxury hotel and you can get a ice cream sundae for $1,500, along with $500 cocktails. You can sit on coyote skin chairs. The luxury tower, the luxury hotel, the luxury restaurants were all in place.
Hardly in the interest of the public sphere, Michael White. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to wrap up some of your thoughts here. We're out of time for this segment and for the program, but it's very obvious that we need to have you back on, because there are several other things that you and I had talked about off air previously that we haven't gotten into yet. So we're definitely going to invite you back, but I wanted to give you a minute and wrap up some of the things that we've talked about today. And I want to ensure listeners that Michael White will be back on the Project Censored show from citizensdefendinglibraries.blogspot.com. Michael?
Well, I do want to say that one of the things we talked about is HD radio, terrestrial radio, high-definition radio, and Pacifica radio. And in that respect, I'll mention that I went on the local station board of WBAI, one of the local Pacifica stations, because I believe that terrestrial radio is so important. And that visual that I mentioned of the five arrows converging on libraries, of forces that are adverse to libraries, I think you can imagine those five arrows converging also on Pacifica terrestrial radio, as not wanting Pacifica to be there getting information out the way it does, because it's information that can't be tracked the way all of the internet interactions are tracked.
Well, Michael White, that's a fascinating topic, and I want to actually dedicate another program to exactly those issues and some of the other things, again, that we've talked about more specifically. I can't thank you enough for the work that you do for Citizens Defending Libraries. Another site that you had shared with us was nationalnotice.blogspot.com. Is there anywhere else that you'd like to tell our listeners to go learn more about your work? And then again, I promise we'll have you back on this summer.
Yeah, the other place I write is Noticing New York. Noticing New York, I often write about libraries. There I write about New York City real estate development and associated politics. National Notice, I'm covering national issues and economics and policy. And I just put up an article there about how the public never gets what it wants, even though huge majorities are desiring very sensible things that we could have and won't cost anything.
In that article, I'm actually looking at it right now. The blog spot is nationalnotice.blogspot.com. Michael White, thank you so much. It's going to take listeners a while, I think, to digest some of the things that you were diving into. And again, I'm going to get some links and other information from you so that when we air the program, when we post it on our website for people to see, I'll make sure I put several links for our listeners to go and find the things that we've been talking about and contact you if they like.
Wonderful. And again, thank you for Project Censored and all its good work.
Michael White, you've been a fantastic guest, and we look forward to having you back. Thanks so much for everything you do.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show, established in 2010 by Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips. Mickey Huff is executive producer and host of the program with myself, Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our senior producer, and Dennis Murphy is our associate producer. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the United States from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work, or to find any of our previous archived programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast app. Feel free to share your feedback about our work, and last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. We'll see you next time. Unthinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks of all the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, and the times for the master thief. Combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love with our brothers and our sisters.